You are listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, September 15th. Today we celebrate a trio of winners of Cleveland's esteemed literary prize, the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. Joining us later is Lifetime Achievement winner John Edgar Wideman, whose Homewood trilogy paints a classic portrait of his home in Pittsburgh. We also meet a novelist who connects the American South of the 19th century with 18th century Baghdad. But first, building a great house.
Me mandaron una carta por el correo temprano. En esa carta me dicen que cayó preso mi hermano.
A novel is like a home full of memories and main characters. Authors construct a solid foundation through research, assemble the structure, and then fill it with family and friends. In her highly praised novel, Great House, Nicole Krauss builds a story whose characters may live disparate lives in distant countries, yet somehow they end up under the same roof. Great House has been called masterful by NPR and eloquent by the Wall Street Journal. Tonight, Nicole Krauss steps onto the stage of the Ohio Theater here in Playhouse Square to accept the 2011 Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction, and she joins us now in Studio 4 of Idea Center at Playhouse Square. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you so much.
As you were constructing this story, I understand you worked on different sections of the book, sometimes in the same day. It wasn't a linear way of writing, so why did you choose that, or did it choose you, did it feel like?
Well, this is my third novel, so by now I have a little bit of a sense of how my mind works or how it likes to put things together. And this is the second novel that I've written in this fashion, which is to say in a kind of improvisation where you have a kind of polyphonic structure, a number of different voices that I began all around the same time and became interested in how they might echo off of each other, how they might amplify each other's stories, how certain patterns could be formed between the voices, and how together these voices have completely different characters, a father in Israel, a husband who's lost a wife in London, a writer in New York, how they could begin to create a whole together.
Mm. And we began with some music from Chile, a country that you became fascinated by, even though you once thought of it as, quote, an almost imaginary place at the end of the world. Do you know what sparked that fascination? What kept it alive?
Yeah, well, Chile had appeared in The History of Love, my last novel, and in that novel it was really an imaginary place. It was a place in which the story of a book within a book kind of unfolds. And I had located The History of Love in places I knew very well. London, where my mother is from, where I spent a lot of time growing up, Israel, where my father grew up partly, and New York. So these are the kind of trio of places of my life. And I wanted this fourth place to expand into, in which to invent this other story. And then I wrote that book, time passed, I became pregnant with my first child. And at the same time, I became fascinated with Chile in a completely new way. Suddenly it became to me a hauntingly real place. I began to read quite obsessively about the history of the country, specifically the Pinochet era and the nightmare of that regime and all of the disappearances that happened under his command, people who were very much like me and could have been my own family. And much later, long after my son was born and that period passed for me, I realized that probably I was trying to find a way to reach down again to, you know, the bottom of the globe there, to touch something in my own life which was untouchable in any other way, this new vulnerability, this fear of bringing this person into the world who I knew from that moment forward, all of my own happiness would depend on his safety, his well-being.
Mm-hmm. The story began as a short story about a poet from Chile. One of the stories, Daniel Varnsky. Tell us about that character.
Yeah, I had written the short story, so this sort of Chilean obsession all culminated in this short story that was called From the Desk of Daniel Varnsky. And it was simply this, a story about this American novelist who in the early 70s meets a young poet who was returning to Chile. She has just broken up with her boyfriend. She has no furniture. She needs some furniture. And this Chilean poet says, sure, take mine. I'm leaving. So she inherits it all. And among those items is this enormous desk. And she begins to write at it. She's a young poet. And time passes. She learns that he has disappeared in the regime and these disappearances. And later she finds out that he dies. And so for the next 24 years or so, she becomes a novelist, a well-known novelist, and she writes at this desk of this disappeared poet. And that was the story, simply the idea of being haunted by this person's past and being bound to it in some inescapable way. And I left the story behind, and my son was born, and I was absorbed in that. And for a long time, I couldn't write again. And part of it was I couldn't find the thing that mattered to me. You know, you're always looking for that thing that's alive in you that needs to be addressed and can't be addressed in any other way except a novel. And I felt like maybe I should go back to that story because there was something there. There was something of that authenticity, that thing that needed to be spoken about. And I thought, what would happen if someone took that desk away from that writer? What would happen to her then? She's come to depend on it so much. So I sort of opened up the seams of the story and started again. And at the same time, all of these other voices began to sort of tumble out together.
Yeah. I'm curious if you as a writer have that sort of icon in your life, a touchstone that helps trigger your creativity.
When I was young, I used to have a variety of things that I thought were necessary to write. But as time has passed and I've gotten older and my life has become busier and writing has become something that I have to make happen, you know, all the time, whenever I can, because in stolen moments, basically, I've sort of given up on the idea of rituals or anything that basically is necessary aside from my mind. Mm. So if it's just that, then I can do it anywhere. I can do it in a hotel room. I can do it in the back of a taxi cab if I need to. And really, this book was written in all kinds of rooms, in all kinds of countries, wherever I could find the time to do it.
Yeah. Would you share something from the book with us?
I would love to. This is one of the voices is an Israeli father named Aaron. And he's lost his wife, and he's sort of facing his own death. He's old, and he has two grown sons, one of whom is estranged, and who he has loved all his life but perhaps never understood and never knew how quite to connect to. And his entire story is about making this last appeal to this child to tell him how he's felt all of these years. Here, let me begin. You see, my child, a little bit every day I find myself contemplating my death, investigating it, dipping my toe, as it were, not practicing so much as interrogating its conditions while I still possess powers of interrogation and can still fathom oblivion. In one of these little excursions into the unknown, I uncovered something about you that I'd almost forgotten. For the first 3 years of your life, you knew nothing of death. You thought that it would all go on without end. On the first night you left your crib behind to sleep in a bed, I came to say goodnight to you. Now I'm going to sleep in a big boy bed forever, you asked. Yes, I said. And we sat together, I imagining you on a flight through the halls of eternity, clutching your blankie, you imagining whatever a child imagines when he tries to conceive of forever. A few days later, you were sitting at the table, playing with the food that you refused to eat. So don't eat, I said. But if you don't eat, you can't leave the table. It's as simple as that. Your lip began to tremble. Go ahead and sleep there for all I care, I said. This isn't how Mama does it, you whined. I don't care how she does it, I spat. This is how I do it, and you're not moving until you eat. You burst into tears, protesting and carrying on. I ignored you. After a while, silence filled the room, punctuated only by your little whimpers. Then, out of nowhere, you announced, "When Yoella dies, we'll get a dog." I was surprised, because of the bluntness of the statement, but also because I had no idea you knew anything of death. Won't you be sad when she dies, I asked, forgetting for a moment the war of the food. And you very practically replied, yes, because then we won't have a cat to pet. A moment passed. What does it look like when people die, you asked. As if they're asleep, I said, only they don't breathe. You thought about this. Do children die, you asked. I felt a pain open in my chest. Sometimes, I said. Perhaps I should have chosen other words, never or simply no. But I didn't lie to you. At least you can say that of me. Then, turning your little face to me, without flinching, you asked, will I die? And as you said, the words horror filled me as it had never before. Tears burned my eyes, and instead of saying what I should have said, not for a long, long time, or not you, my child, you alone will live forever, I said simply, yes. And because no matter how you suffered, deep inside you were still an animal like any other who wants to live and feel the sun and be free, you said, but I don't want to die. The terrible injustice of it filled you, and you looked at me as if I were responsible.
The words of Nicole Krauss. She was reading from her novel Great House, which is a co-winner of this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction. She accepts her prize during tonight's ceremony here at Playhouse Square. And Nicole, I wanted to have you talk a bit about the title of the book, Great House. Did you mean that in any other than the literal sense?
Well, there is a direct reference that comes late in the book, which is a reference to something in Jewish history, a famous house of study that burned when the Romans sort of besieged and sacked Jerusalem. And the Jews, of course, afterwards were exiled and sort of sent off into the diaspora. And there is a line in the book about the idea of all of Jewish memory, everyone holding a piece of this kind of house, not that literal house, but the house itself, which could in somehow, if everyone were put back together again, you would have this house whole again. But really, in a way, that's not for me the most significant idea. I've always thought of houses as novels, as houses. From the first one I started to write, I felt somehow, for many reasons, both structurally, the way that I like to build, as we spoke about at the beginning, put these pieces together, a house from the inside, almost, if you can imagine, the first thing I do is just the tiny detail, like a doorknob. And then I have to figure out the shape of the door that is appropriate for that doorknob, and then I have to open that door, build the room, and then build the adjacent rooms. And this structure is appearing while I'm writing. From the inside, I have no sense of a larger blueprint from the beginning or anything like that. And it's only as I'm finishing the novel and walking away that I get to see this whole structure. And I suppose on another level, a novel feels to me like a house because I live in it for so many years. And it is the place in the world that feels most like home to me. I think a lot of writers feel in some way a little bit outside of things, somehow a little bit exiled from things. But they, in their novels, they create the world where they feel home, comfortable. Mm.
That makes me wonder about how early in life writing became that for you. Was your childhood filled with moving, or was there something else going on that made you gravitate towards a place, a thing that would anchor you?
Oh, I think it must be many things. It's always hard to lie in the sort of psychoanalyst couch and figure out how these things begin. But I do know, of course, family history being what it is, you sort of know where you come from. And in my case, I come from so many places that it was very hard to call any one place home. And certainly, I never was brought up feeling that America or any place in America or any place at all was the place for us. I mean, my grandparents came from four different countries and all in Europe and all had to leave because of World War II. And my mother, as I said, was from London. My father grew up in Israel. So there's this sense of home being elsewhere somehow, or home being something one had to construct in a very abstract way that you could carry with you anywhere, that the suitcases maybe were always on top of the closet ready to be packed. And I'm sure that has contributed to not only being a writer, but obviously the kind of subjects that I'm drawn to.
Yeah. And on the note of those subjects, the Annisfield Wolf Book Award is a prize that honors writing about diversity and multiculturalism, among other things. When you look at the book that you've written, is there a sense for you of what the jurors tapped into, what diversity they were looking at, and maybe it might be a different one than what you see in your novel.
It's hard to, it's one sort of quakes to imagine what the jurors were thinking when they were reading your book. I feel so grateful that they chose it. I mean, really, so deeply honored, because I admire each of the judges very much. Each of them are sort of extraordinary people and writers and thinkers. I hope that this book, I hope everything that I will write, but I hope this book wants to, tries to draw together lots of disparate things into a sense of a kind of, the sense of how, of people connecting in some way. I mean, all of the characters in this book are struggling to transcend themselves and make contact, deep, meaningful contact with others in their life. And I think that I've always felt that that's a struggle, that for all of us, it seems to me that that's a sort of daily struggle, but that it is a sort of the greatest struggle that we can try to tackle. And I hope somehow that was, I suspect that may be part of it, but I don't know.
Yeah. As you're going around talking about this particular book, I'm wondering if there's something already on your writing desk or whatever implement you use that is filling that home space now.
I'm right in that early chaotic stage of sort of kicking up lots of dust and trying to figure out what it is that draws me, what compels me, and what I can't resist writing about. Because unless it feels absolutely necessary, I find that I can't carry on with it. You know, I can't write a story just because it feels like a good story. It has to be something urgent to me, necessary. And that's actually a difficult thing to find. But I've started a few things, and so at least the desk isn't empty anymore. And having done it now a few times, I have a kind of shaky faith that that it will work out, that a book will begin to find its way to me or I to it.
Excellent. It's such a pleasure talking with you and turning the pages of the book as well. Nicole, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Nicole Krauss, who is the author of Great House. She is also a co-winner of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction. And this evening, beginning at 6, she will be a part of the ceremony that happens in the Ohio Theater as those prizes are delivered. For more information, you can call 216-241-6000. That's 216-241-6000. Or just log on to our homepage today at wcpn.org, where you can hear our show on demand and comment on what you hear. Up next, you will hear from other winners of the Anisfield Wolf Book Award as we celebrate that prize during this hour of Around Noon on 90.3.
También tengo un hermano fuera del que se engrilló. Nueve son comunistas con el favor de mi Dios. Sí.
This is 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
Georgia. Georgia. The whole day through. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia has been on the mind of Mary Helen Stefaniak since she was a little girl. Her mother grew up in the area around Milledgeville, Georgia, and the author has said that when she was a child, she didn't know there was any such thing as a vacation that wasn't a trip to Georgia. That background surely came in handy as Mary Helen Stefaniak was writing the book, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. She set parts of her novel in a 1930s Georgia town that the inhabitants originally called Three Step. How it came to be Baghdad is the story Stefaniak tells in the pages of her book, and it's that storytelling that prompted the Anisfield Wolf Book Award jurors to give her an award for fiction writing this year. The author will accept her prize during this evening's ceremony at the Ohio Theater, and she joins us now in Studio 4 of Idea Center for today's Around Noon. And Mary Helen, welcome. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Dee. Now, most of your upbringing happened in and around Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I was struck by a comment of yours as you were writing in answer to why Georgia, why Baghdad, that In 1960s Milwaukee, de facto segregation was so complete you didn't meet a single African American until high school. I wondered how that compared to the surroundings you experienced when you were visiting Georgia.
Well, it was very different. Most of my family lived in kind of rural, small-town areas around Milledgeville and Macon. And my aunt, we would visit, for example, my aunt Sissy in Jones County. And she lived in the little town of Haddock, Georgia. And her neighbors across the road were black, and the neighbors down the road behind her house were black, and her children and their children played together. And so it seemed to me that one big difference between the North and the South, you know, in my childhood wisdom, was that there were black people and white people in the South. And of course, I realized also very early on that there were rules that restricted. It wasn't just a happy union at all times, but
There was a little line in that same quote where you described being there on vacation in the summertime and being uncertain about where to sit at a lunch counter.
Yes. You knew, and I'd be very, very young, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and go into the Woolworths in Macon, and if there wasn't someone, or I knew there was some kind of rule about where you were supposed to sit. So it made you a little bit, put you a little bit on edge. But you really did, when you're trying to make sense to yourself as a child of things like, you know, a sign on a door or a drinking fountain, which I should call a bubbler because I'm from Milwaukee, we say bubbler, but that says whites only or colored only, and then when I would go back to my experience, the assumption was not, oh, well, you know, we are not segregated in Milwaukee. It was that, well, they're all white people here, so why would you put a sign that said white, you know, so that you don't, making sense of it was, I kind of made a sort of backward sense of it, I think, at the time.
Mm-hmm. You've been writing about Southern things, though, since you were a young girl. Did you also read a lot of Southern authors?
Well, I don't know that I read a lot of Southern authors as a young girl. I certainly have since. I was in high school when I found out that my mother had gone to high school with Flannery O'Connor and graduated 1 year. My mom graduated in 43 and Flannery in 42. And that became something that meant a lot to me, in part because, I've read a lot of Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty and Cormac McCarthy, lots of, you know, Southern writers, but I always had kind of a special relationship with Flannery O'Connor. It was stunning to me that I had some kind of personal connection to this name, this story, and the anthology we were reading in English class. So in that sense, I think it was something that probably helped me think that, well, maybe I could do that too, or, you know, at least it was something that real people did. It wasn't just a name on the page. But there was also the issue of the kinds of stories Flannery O'Connor writes, and it was pretty evident to me from the start that my mother's family belonged to the socioeconomic class from which Flannery O'Connor drew her characters, you know, her crazy, you know, rural, grotesque characters, rather than the one to which she belonged. So that, I think, there also was a certain amount of mission in my writing. Whenever I write about, because I've written other stories that are drawn from my mother's background, and there's a little bit of mission of trying to say, well, Flannery O'Connor's South is not everybody's South, you know.
What else sparked your imagination and pushed you in the direction of writing stories? I mean, were there storytellers, oral storytelling? Was that big in your family or no?
Well, that was pretty big, actually, on both sides of the family. My mother's family, it was you would always hear wonderful stories from her sisters and also her great aunts. My mother was raised by her grandparents because her mother died in childbirth when the last child was born. And so there was kind of a mix of older and younger people. And so it was always a good thing when we would take our trips to Georgia, especially as we got older, to just sit and listen while people told about, you know, the crazy thing they did. And also in my dad's family, my grandparents on my father's side immigrated from a Croatian village in Hungary. My father was really the only member of the family born and raised in the U.S. And his sister, Madeline, was storyteller extraordinaire, although you needed an index to keep track of what she was talking about. But so there was a lot of storytelling. I did feel as though I inherited, in a sense, I inherited a lot of material, you know, that deserved a voice.
Yeah. Speaking of voices, you chose to make 11-year-old Gladys Califf the narrator of your book, The Califfs of Baghdad, Georgia. Why was hers the voice that you chose?
Well, I think I needed someone who would be able to fall in love with Miss Spivey and forgive some of the poor judgment, you know, and not see it that Miss Spivey shows. And also, I mean, there's plenty that the teacher, the well-traveled young school teacher who comes and turns Three-Step Georgia upside down. She does a lot that's right, that's good, but she also does a lot that's risky and kind of irresponsible, both personally and with the children. So I wanted someone who would be on Miss Spivey's side through thick and thin. So that's one reason. And also, I guess, because my perspective on the 1930s in Georgia is one that I got from my mother and her sisters, and they were children, you know, at that time. So so the research just involved calling a lot of people on the telephone and asking them about things. I mean, it involved things other than that. But actually capturing the voice, that's what you would do if you sort of lost yourself in trying to write the voice, all I'd have to do is call my Aunt Frances and talk to her for a while, and then I was right back in it again.
Isn't that something? Would you describe a little bit of the story that Gladys tells, and then we'll hear a passage from the book, if you would?
Oh, okay. You mean to talk a little bit about what the book is about?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of it takes place during the 1938-39 school year, when a new school teacher comes to this little town of Three-Step, Georgia. And she's a well-traveled young woman, and she kind of ditches the curriculum in favor of a more inclusive curriculum. She likes to read to the children from the Thousand and One Nights, not the Disney versions of these stories, but the pretty, you know, R-rated versions, although Miss Spivey was careful not to read the R-rated portions to the students. One of the ways in which Miss Spivey turns things upside down is she revives the annual town festival, which has sort of gone defunct as a result of the Depression. And in fact, she's encouraged to do that by the townspeople, because the school was always central to the town festival. But Miss Spivey revives it as a Baghdad bazaar. She's traveled in the Middle East, and she's very taken with all of that. And ultimately, they go to a circus in Macon and get some camels and make quite a show of it. She gets herself in some difficulty, and not only herself, when she brings a young African-American teenager who's the neighbor of the Califfs and friends with Gladys's the children in Gladys's family, a young man named Theo Boykin, who is just kind of a genius at all sorts of things. And he becomes the chief. He's just a great inventor and problem solver, and he can draw what she wants, you know, wants the set to look like and things like that. So he becomes what she calls the chief engineer of the Baghdad Bazaar. But not everybody likes that.
Yeah. And I'd love to have you share a passage from the book.
Okay.
Do we need to know any more than you've just told us?
No, I think the only thing you would need to know is I'd like to read a page or so about Theo that introduces Theo Boykin as a character. Really the only thing you would need to know is that prior to the Baghdad Bazaar, Miss Spivey kind of has a dry run with a Halloween party, a community Halloween party. And so that's the event that they're looking for toward here. And Gladys and her brothers immediately recommend to Miss Spivey that if she really wants to have a terrific haunted house, she has to get Theo Boykin on the job. So that's how. This is from a chapter called A Bedouin at the Window. Theo Boykin was the smartest person in Piedmont County, and everybody knew it. Whether folks liked it or not was another matter. Theo, who was about the same age as my brother Force, 17, could do sums in his head better than Mrs. Bibbins' adding machine at the store, and he could read you anything he laid his hands on, even if he never saw it before in his life, without ever stumbling over a single word. One 4th of July, when the parade marshal of Piedmont County waited till the last minute to line up his post-parade program, he couldn't find but one person in Claytonville, Brennan, and Three Step combined who knew all the words to the Declaration of Independence. Theo was 10 or 11 at the time. You'd better believe a murmur went through the audience when he stepped up to the podium on the courthouse lawn in Claytonville that day, but by the time he got to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he had the whole audience in the palm of his hand. I'm told they applauded louder and longer for Theophilus Boykin than they had for the tap dancers or the Land of Liberty tableau.
And that is an excerpt from the book by Mary Helen Stefaniak called The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. Mary Helen is winner of one of the fiction prizes being given out this evening as part of the 2011 Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, and the ceremony will be held in the Ohio Theater of Playhouse Square. Mary Helen joins us in Idea Center at Playhouse Square for today's Around Noon. And I enjoy hearing you take on that voice because it brings to life the family members that you were mentioning earlier. And I was aware that you thought of this book at first as a set of connected short stories about those family members. How did it become the book that it is now? How did Baghdad get into the picture?
Well, Baghdad came into the picture. It was a big surprise to me in March 2003. When I was reading a newspaper account of the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad. And a thing that came into my head was selfish sort of thing, I suppose, was we're bombing the cradle of civilization. You know, we're bombing ourselves by bombing Baghdad. The roots of Western culture which also are the same as the roots of Islamic culture, you know, and Judaic culture. So what I wanted to do, all I had to go on was I wanted to write a book in which a group of Americans had a different relationship to Baghdad than the one that was being developed at the time that I thought was kind of obfuscating and taking away all sorts of meanings and feelings for Baghdad, and not just the city of Baghdad, but the whole swath of, you know, history and culture, as I said, that it represents, and that was being turned into something else and being lost sight of. So so that's what I wanted to do. And then I knew that having written The Turk and My Mother, my previous novel, as I said, drawing on my father's background, his Austro-Hungarian background, I knew I wanted to I'd been planning to write this book of short stories, right, mm-hmm. where there was a story for every one of my great aunts. And so that's where my material was already coming from. And I really just started from there. Really, the name Caliph actually was a kind of a funny thing because that is a family name.
Yeah, I saw that.
And in point of fact, I've had my mother point out to me that Caliph, you know, is the same as the ruler of Baghdad, and that just goes to show you, Mary Helen, that we go way, way back. And of course, it's that actual linguistic connection doesn't exist, but there it was, a pun, you know. And I knew I couldn't write the whole novel just developing a pun, so I had to turn to 1001 Nights, and then I started doing other research and discovered that. You know, that Baghdad, that Islam, that the Middle East was already there in Georgia in descendants of former slaves who had been brought from West Africa, which is something I knew nothing about, that there were literate Muslims, you know, enslaved from Africa, enslaved in the South.
It's a fascinating full circle journey that you take us on, and stories within stories within stories. It's a lovely and well-textured book, too, even though it's told in the voice of a young girl. There's a lot there to think about. Thank you, too, Mary Helen. It's a great pleasure to meet you
and to read the book.
Mary Helen Stefaniak is my guest. She is one of the winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, who will be honored this evening in a ceremony that begins at 6 at the Ohio Theater. You are hearing her as part of today's Around Noon, and you can find out more about the awards ceremony and the authors that we are talking to today when you go to the Around Noon section of our website online at WCPN.org. Up next, we talk with the Annisfield Wolf's Lifetime Achievement Award winner, and you will hear that conversation as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
Keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia.
I say just an old sweet song. Keeps Georgia on my mind.
It is 14 minutes before 1 o'clock as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. When you look back at the life of John Edgar Wideman, two themes emerge: writing and basketball. His talents for both took him far in life, from his hometown of Homewood, Pennsylvania, to an Ivy League college as an athlete, and to Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. Family is at the center of much of Wideman's writing, like his novel Sent for You Yesterday and his memoir Brothers and Keepers. In 2003, though, both of his passions converged in his acclaimed book of nonfiction, Hoop Roots: Basketball, Race, and Love. Tonight I have the distinct privilege of handing John Edgar Wideman the 2011 Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Lifetime Achievement, and I'm honored to have him here with us today in the Idea Center studios. Thank you, sir, for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
I'm wondering, which came first for you in life, basketball or writing?
I think maybe writing, actually. Because I didn't start playing basketball till I was about 11 years old, playing it seriously in school and on school teams. But already by that time, I was a reader. And my aunts had taken me to the library, and I was pretty sure the world of books was something that is just very, very attractive and a place to escape and something I wanted to do. And So the books came first.
Yeah. Was there a particular kind of book you liked, or did anything printed on a page appeal to you?
Well, mostly I like to eat. So if I could have found a book I could eat and read and say, that would have been great. But I couldn't find those. I had a pretty omnivorous kind of attitude about books anyway. Mm-hmm. But I liked the books that took me far away from my circumstances. I loved my family, and I only knew one kind of world, the world I was in, but I knew there were other worlds. Mm-hmm. And if you grow up young and if you grow up black in America, you always have that sense of that there's another world or other worlds hovering. But they're scary, and you don't necessarily want to go there. But books were a way to get there and preview things. Yeah. I loved the Greek myths.
Did you?
And I had a couple of those big golden books that probably some folks have given them to their kids as recently as yesterday. But the golden book of myth, the pictures, this crazy adventures, people changing from human beings to animals and flying and being mean to one another. I was just fascinated by all that.
The things that you've written about have the ring of reality. You grew up in an area outside of Pittsburgh, as we mentioned, called Homewood. Does the Homewood you write about connect one-to-one with the Homewood you grew up in?
No. That's an easy one to answer. Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, my own growing up, watching my younger siblings grow up after I'd gone away to college. All that is sort of conflated and all that swimming around in my mind, and I feel quite free as a writer to dip into any one of those pots or any one of those colors when I'm trying to make a picture of this place called Homewood. And Homewood is not a suburb. It's sort of at the eastern end of Pittsburgh, but very much a part of the city. And it's surrounded on by various kinds of communities, some very well-off communities and some very poor. But I also spent a lot of time in other areas of Pittsburgh, particularly Shadyside, which was an upper middle class, mainly white neighborhood at that time. I hate those words, black and white, because they have such history in them. We think we know what we're talking about, but it's like talking about time. If you stop for a minute, you realize black and white are just concessions to our ignorance and shorthand. But anyway, it was mainly white community.
the shorthand. And you learned how to write by observing writers, by observing life, by taking classes. How?
Probably all of the above eventually. I think as much as written sources, which of course are important, the oral sources. Yeah. And in my case, the women in my family. I had a good when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. We lived in a very poor neighborhood and we weren't materially privileged, but I had my mother. She had sisters, and my grandmother was around, and my grandmother's sisters were around. So I was around a community of women, a very vibrant community of women. And actually very few men were around. Men were working during the day. Men were separated from their families. Men were just not around. I didn't know why they weren't around. But anyway, those women took care of me in such a way that I was spoiled, hopelessly spoiled. And I'll never have it so good again. And I'm not complaining. Everybody should start out that way. Mm-hmm. And I love to listen to them tell stories.
What did they tell stories about?
Well, some were for me and some weren't. Sometimes they were talking about the men who weren't around. Sometimes they weren't so much storytelling sessions per se as it was the fact that their lives were made up of language and music. They'd sing songs. We'd go to church. They'd sing the church songs. The radio would be on. I'd hear gospel. And they'd talk about their lives. They'd talk about weddings and crazy folks in the family, trips they'd taken, the time everybody went to see a Steelers game in Cleveland, and the car broke down, and Ernie had to drive the car from Cleveland back to Pittsburgh backward in reverse because that was the only gear, you know, so, and all that. And this storytelling went on. I'm calling it storytelling, but it was just the vitality, the verbal energy, and as I understand it now, these women were making an alternative reality. Mm. They were powerless in terms of the larger world. They're really, in a sense, at the bottom. And no one was asking them what they thought. They weren't going to run for political office. Even their status in terms of the people who loved them was not, in many ways, a very high status. They had the very particular job, traditional kinds of roles. So over and against that, they could have simply accepted that other people's point of view. But no, they didn't. They generated their own point of view on everything. They had an attitude about everything. They had an answer for everything. And the audience, for the most part, was one another. Mm-hmm. But they could go anywhere, do anything. They had tremendous confidence. I was always proud to be with the women in my family because they didn't take any nonsense from anybody else. They didn't feel inferior. And I think it's because of that network of language that they created to sustain themselves.
And one of the things I like about your writing is that same vitality that's in the language and in the speech and in the way of telling a story. And I would love it if you would share some of that writing with us.
Well, I just couldn't wait for you to ask. I've been running through this book of stories. This is a book of my last book. I'm working on a book about Lewis Till now, Emmett Till's father. But this is a book of short pieces, and intentionally very short, just to see what happens when you compress stories into maybe a page. A story about color for children born with many. For Q, my granddaughter. Do you ever wonder what color you are, Q? No word for your color, sweetheart. Your color is a story, not a word. Many, many stories. Before you accept anybody's word for your color, look in the mirror. Looking is listening, because what you will see in the mirror are stories. Voices inside you tell. But the voices can't begin a story. Can't say green girl in the mirror, or say black girl, or say brown girl, or say red girl without words. A voice can't even say girl without words. A story needs words, and words need a language like French or Arabic or English or Chinese or chimpanzee, so you can understand what others mean when they say a word. Imagine the baby you were 12 years ago, Q, a less than 1 year old searching for her color in a mirror. Without language, without words, what would she see? Would she just stare and stare silently? Or maybe get bored and make up her own ga-ga-ga language? If she has no word for bored, could she get bored? Or just keep on quietly staring, you know, like dogs and cats stare forever unless hunger or fright or sleep steal her eyes from the mirror, because the strongest feelings don't need words to get us moving, do they? Maybe the cute baby would stare into the mirror until someone calls her. But how would she know someone's calling her if she doesn't learn a language people use when they want her or don't want her, or want her to say something, or want to say something about her, like the name of her color? No girl, certainly not the one in this story who's sort of like you, Q, wants to stare forever, or be silent forever, or alone forever, so she learns words like happy, Q, or like shoe, tree, or words for a rainbow of colors. And if she's quick and smart like you, she makes words into stories about what she thinks and feels and sees, makes up her own stories about her many colors in the mirror, stories that will help her live happily ever after.
John Edgar Wideman, thank you for the words, sir. I wish we had more time, but I am glad that people will get a chance to hear you again this afternoon at 3 o'clock during Tell Me More on 90.3 with Michelle Martin. And tonight, if they're there at the ceremony, congratulations, and we really appreciate you being here.
I'm happy to be in Cleveland.
John Edgar Wideman has been my guest. He is the winner of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award for Lifetime Achievement. Tonight, he and the rest of this year's winners are honored here at Playhouse Square in a ceremony that begins at 6 p.m. in the Ohio Theater. That ceremony is free, but only a few seats remain. You can find out if some are left by calling 216-241-6000. That's 216-241-6000. Or just log on to our homepage today online at wcpn.org, where you can hear the show on demand and comment on what you hear. You can also hear the Sound of Ideas conversation with the nonfiction winners, Isabel Wilkerson, as well as David Eltis and David Richardson, all on wcpn.org. And thanks for tuning in. Yeah.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.